I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
I want to welcome everyone to this special conversation on the American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about a very interesting topic. I think probably one that is not talked about enough among folks who love American history and America's principles. And that's the topic of free enterprise and national prosperity. Folks are joining us from all over the place, and we're going to have some time for question and answer. Please feel free to use the Q&A function on the bottom of your screen there if you want to jump in with some questions. We'll try to get to as many of those as we can. But for the conversation tonight, free enterprise and national prosperity, particularly focusing on the debate between Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton and what that has meant for America even today. I'm joined by two friends, personal friends, but also, of course, friends of the Ashbrook Center. Professor Christopher Burkett and Professor Robert Wiley. Chris is professor of political science at Ashland University. He teaches in Ashbrook's programs for students, our Ashbrook Scholar Program, High School Academy. He also teaches in our teacher programs, our Teaching American History seminars, which many of you know about, and of course, our Master of Arts in American History and Government. He is a scholar of American political thought, in particularly the American founding. So we're lucky to have Chris with us tonight. Our other panelist is Professor Robert Wiley. Rob is professor of political economy at Ashland University. He directs Ashbrook's political economy program and is a real expert in political thought and its connection to economics and economic thinking. So we've got a couple of great panelists with us tonight. I want to encourage conversation, as I say, with the Q&A function. Gentlemen, thanks for joining me today.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks. Let me start with this. When we think of Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton, we think of rivals. We maybe even think of bitter enemies. That's certainly what they seem to have become over the years, although it's a complicated relationship for sure. Anybody who's seen the musical Hamilton knows that it's complicated. But I'm wondering, to start with, what they agreed on if we're talking about free enterprise, national prosperity, and the kind of foundations of those things. I'm thinking moral foundations, philosophical principles. I want to start the conversation by kind of grounding it in that. And I'm particularly thinking about the Declaration of Independence. The draft is written by Thomas Jefferson. It seems to have been fully embraced by Alexander Hamilton. There seems to have been a moment where Jefferson and Hamilton agreed on foundational ideas and principles that serve as the basis for things like free enterprise in America. Chris, maybe we'll start with you. Can you talk a little bit about Jefferson and Hamilton on first principles?
Sure, yeah. I think on first principles, I think there was actually a lot of agreement between them, at least in the sources from which they derived their principles. We know that both of them, for example, believed in natural rights, and they grounded their political thought, and I would say their economic thought, on an understanding of natural rights. And from that understanding, they both understood the right to private property, especially, to be an important natural right. We know Jefferson believed these things from many writings, and he penned the words of the Declaration of Independence. Of course, he did not include the right to property in the line or the list of unalienable rights. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are included. But he also says among these rights are these three things. We know from a lot of other things that Jefferson wrote that clearly he believed that property was an important natural right. And Alexander Hamilton, similarly, as a very young man, he wrote a response to a loyalist Hamilton's piece was called A Farmer Refuted, in which he also supported the idea of natural rights and also an understanding of property as a natural right. And I think what they both had in common was this belief that property rights were especially important because property in the physical sense was derived from the property that human beings or individuals had in themselves by virtue of them being created human beings and endowed with life and liberty. So because we are born free, and especially with free minds, as I think they both believed, we are free to order our actions. It's actually a very Lockean, I think they both had a very Lockean in some way understanding of the origin of natural rights. But we are born with free minds. We can order our own actions. And from our actions, our labor is the cause of the creation of property. We acquire private property through our free actions that we choose through the labor of our own minds and bodies. I think they, at least that's a start. That's the thing they have in common. From there, they start to get into differences. But
sure. Yeah. Rob, can you say a little bit more about that? Jefferson and Hamilton's views on kind of the moral foundations of private property?
Yeah, I think maybe I'll take a different tack than Professor Burkitt took. And while Professor Burkitt emphasized some of their similarities, maybe I'll introduce some of those differences that he alluded to as well. One thing that I think is important to mention off the bat is that they have a very different attitude towards theory and speculation, or what Hamilton calls wild speculative paradoxes, which as a young student at Columbia, maybe they learned some wild speculative paradoxes there, I don't know, watching the news. But he thinks that you can get carried away with theory, and his emphasis is sort of always on the practical. And Jefferson's not the opposite, but he's, I think, very different in temperament, and he's always referring to theory kind of first. So when it comes to their theories about, let's think about one very important economic right, and that's the right to choose your occupation. The right to choose your occupation. Neither, I think, are down the line classical liberals who affirm your right to choose your occupation and see in your right to choose your occupation, this will lead to the division of labor, this will lead market forces, will lead every person to develop their talents. And both Hamilton and Jefferson are uncomfortable with this for different reasons. So in his report on on manufacturers, amazing December 1791, when the Department of the Treasury could produce a major theoretical work, maybe introducing the infant industries argument, and maybe the cornerstone of what some Americans still today see as sort of the American system in economics. Hamilton introduces an idea that might be familiar to anyone today that might read Cass Sunstein or Richard Thaler on nudges, that we don't need to tell people what to do, but we should give them a nudge. Maybe we should put the candy that's worse for you on the top shelf and you know, the school lunchroom, and put the healthy fruit there. And that gives people a nudge. Hamilton writes in the report on manufacturers that people need a nudge because experience teaches that men are so often much governed by what they are accustomed to see in practice. And he's worrying that Americans won't choose manufacturing occupations. They won't innovate, they won't form businesses, they won't form financial concerns for the circulation of capital. They'll farm as they always have. So Hamilton says we should give people a little nudge. Maybe they have the right to choose their occupation, sure, but we can nudge people along, and somehow policymakers might see echoes of this in the Green New Deal or echoes of this in the Inflation Reduction Act when we talk about policymakers giving us a nudge to put those solar panels on our houses, even if we live in Alaska, or buy an electric car or something like that, even if it costs more to run than a gas-powered vehicle. So Hamilton has a little bit of that nudge in him. Jefferson, on the other hand, I think, in theory, and he always says in theory, but Americans, But when he becomes a statesman, he says, I have a duty to Americans to not simply indulge my own theory. I'm a public servant. But he says, in theory, if I had my druthers, the farmers are the chosen people of the earth. Farmers are morally more righteous. Farmers will fight for their countries. Their lives and their capital are fixed. They have no choice but to fight for their countries. He echoes an interesting line that people forget is written by Adam Smith, that the merchant has no country. This is something that Smith is worried about, too. A nation of farmers, he thinks, will be more virtuous. So neither of them, I think, are strong defenders of our rights to choose our occupations, no matter what they are. And I would say, but they have a difference. If Hamilton wants to nudge you into manufacturing, Jefferson thinks you're morally better off. We're morally better off on the country if you stay on the farm, ready to defend home.
So that's interesting because, as you're saying, they share a certain foundational belief that the right to private property is a natural right. It's like life and liberty, pursuit of happiness. Property fits in there, but they come to some different policy conclusions. What it means for the law, for government policy. Can I just take a little bit of a step back and talk? Have you talk, Chris, a little bit more about that natural right to property? And I'm thinking of, for example, one of the great documents of the Revolutionary era, the Virginia Declaration of Rights, which in the very first section, I think, says that human beings have a right to acquire and possess property.
Right.
And I think even some Supreme Court opinions have called this the Lockean bundle of property.
Yeah, right.
The right to acquire property, the right to possess the property you acquire, the right to use the property you possess, and then the right to dispose of it, to sell it, to give it away. Would you say that Jefferson and Hamilton, broadly speaking, embraced that understanding of the right of private property?
Yeah, again, I think they both would, but I think that bundle, it's great that you got all four aspects of that property. I think where you start to see them diverge, one reason you see them start to disagree on some things is because and I don't want to overdo this, but Jefferson was extraordinarily anti-aristocratic in the European sense. It's sort of ironic that he's calling for a country of sort of aristocratic farmers in a sense. But Jefferson saw the problem with a European aristocracy is that the laws, that is the government, actually stood in the way of people being able to exercise that right to property, unless you were part of an exclusive class of landed aristocrats, right? So what Jefferson hoped, I think sincerely hoped, was that more and more Americans, in fact, perhaps all someday, could exercise all four aspects of that right to property. The right to acquire, to hold, to use, and dispose. As you know, in Europe, the aristocracy, the laws of the aristocracy, especially the laws of primogeniture and entail, prevented people from acquiring and then disposing a property as they saw fit. So I think that started to build in Jefferson's mind the idea that the best way to protect the right to property and diffuse property among more people is to eliminate laws and, in a certain sense, keep the role of government in regulating this to a minimum. Whereas Hamilton, on the other hand, as we know, he had a more favorable view of some of the elements of the British constitutional tradition. And he began to see that the role of the government could have a stronger hand in, I mean, Professor Wiley calls it nudging, right? But jumpstarting and supporting, doing more positive things to promote the diffusion of property, though not in a landed way, as Jefferson really sort of hoped for, but in a wage sort of way of diffusing property. So,
because both of them would have agreed, right, that one of the moral foundations of a free enterprise system of private property is you own your labor, whether you're laboring as a farmer, whether you're laboring as a manufacturer, a merchant, you own your labor.
Right. For Jefferson, because you owned your labor, Jefferson had, I think, again, in theory, as Professor Wiley points out, as he speculates about these things, there's something, I think, for Jefferson more noble in using your labor in a way that is connected to the land that you own. It tends to cultivate certain virtues in you. Whereas, again, they both would have agreed, Jefferson and Hamilton, that because it is your labor, you have a right to contract that out for wages, But and for Hamilton, and I'm sure Professor Wiley can say a lot more about this, for Hamilton, that was a very practical way of, again, getting more property into the hands of people through the form of a wage. But for Jefferson, there was something, I think, degrading about the idea of contracting your labor out somehow. I'm not sure if degrading is the right word, but it wasn't as noble as...
Bob, talk about that. And if they agreed on the right that you own your labor, and that's the foundation of a foundational element of private property, is there a difference among them on what that means?
I think it's really important to emphasize that for Jefferson, it's the right of the living to their own labor. And one of the problems that Professor Burkett mentioned, this is also another way in which Adam Smith and Thomas Jefferson are concerned about the same thing. Later, I'll say something, I'm sure, about how Jefferson takes a route that French economists take, and Smith follows, or Hamilton follows Smith in other ways. But this is a way that Smith and Hamilton and Jefferson are worried about the same thing. They're worried about entails. Mm-hmm. So I know we're all very sad that Professor Carl Rogers Stevens couldn't be on the podcast tonight. So in her honor, I'll say that it's readers of Pride and Prejudice who mostly remember what entails are.
Yeah, tell us, remind our listeners and the folks who are joining us,
Mr. Bennett can't sell his estate because it's held in entail, in fee entail. And so the estate will pass to the next male heir, and he only has daughters. So it's especially important in Pride and Prejudice because the estate that's central to the plot is held in fee entail, that he marry his daughters well, or that his daughters marry well. Cue the sort of parlor drama of the book, which I'm sure is wonderful. But the point is that the problem is that if you hold your land in entail, your private property long after you're dead, you can stipulate who it goes to. Smith thinks most land in Scotland is held in entail by noble families. This makes sense in the Middle Ages, where your power as a family is to amass as much land as possible. One of the great 18th century problems, whether you're a Frenchman or a Scotchman, is that all of this land is being held by these huge families and not being used productively. And no one wants the same thing to happen in America, right? We have all this land and we want it to be used productively. So Jefferson's worried about entail, right? And that's one of the things he does with George Wythe and others, right? Where he goes through the common law with a red pen in that committee for the Virginia House of Delegates, and he gets rid of primogeniture. These are elements of the common law that won't serve. And they're also ways of thinking about property rights, that the dead have property rights, that Smith also says, if we give the dead property rights, we don't have them, and we get none of the benefits of them. And so that natural rights are held by living people is the important principle, and I think the revolutionary principle here. So it's kind of one property rights tradition against an older one, and one that avails, one that we hardly recognize now as a private property rights tradition, but maybe a sort of medieval noble families idea of
yeah. In fact, I think, I don't want a spoiler alert, but Downton Abbey, I think the very first episode, the whole show starts, if anybody's watched it, a crisis because the male heir dies on the Titanic sinking, and because of entail, there's this whole, now the oldest daughter has got to get married.
Right. We have to go to these British shows and novels to figure out what it is now, because our founders left us in much, much better, stead.
Well, all right. So when I think about if there is this kind of broad agreement on the underlying moral principles of a free enterprise system, one of the things we think about in free enterprise is, of course, it as an engine of the creation of wealth, a term that's commonly used, wealth creator. The entrepreneur who's a wealth creator, the person engaging in free enterprise is a wealth creator. If thinking again about Jefferson and Hamilton, do they have a shared understanding, or what's their particular views? Maybe we'll start with you, Rob, on what wealth actually is.
So in Adam Smith's book, An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations, everyone remembers the causes. People make free and voluntary exchanges. Everyone benefits every time one of those exchanges is made. People then specialize, division of labor, and wealth is created in this way. But people forget the nature. What's the nature of wealth, which is the first part of that title. And when Smith looks out into the world, he says there are two accounts that people give of the nature of wealth. And this is important because Hamilton's going to fall on one side, Jefferson the other. Some people think wealth is money. He calls them mercantilists, or Smith calls this the system of commerce. And that, I think, today makes sense, too. If I were to ask you who the wealthiest man in the world was, you'd tell me maybe Elon Musk, because he has the most money. Then we might go see what he can do with that money. Is it tied up in Tesla stocks? Is it leveraged? Maybe he's not as wealthy as we think when we think about the purchasing power of that money. We think that wealth is money. If wealth is money, this has important political implications that Smith critiques. And this is part of Adam Smith's critique of empire, which I think becomes part of the founder's critique of empire too. But if you think that wealth is money, you want to sell more than you buy. That's a, by the way, makes sense. And when my wife uses the credit card, you know, I'd like her to have, you know, remember that too. Sell more than you buy, produce more than you consume. And for nations, export more than you import. And that will bring money into the nation just like it brings money into a family, et cetera. This becomes a logic for empire because we don't want to buy things from our rivals. We think we're locked in competition with them. And if we don't want to buy tobacco from anyone else, then we make Virginia England. If England doesn't want to buy tobacco, you can only grow tobacco. We're going to make Virginia England, and we're going to build colonies. And the idea of those 18th century empires, I mean, earlier than that, these sort of mercantile empires that begin in the 16th century, they're markets. And the English don't trade with the French and vice versa because they're locked in competition. Any money, anytime you buy a French wine, right, that puts money in the hands of the King of France, a French soldier that's going to come and bayonet you someday. So this become no trade or no buying from other countries, just selling, becomes kind of like the logic for empire. Smith also thinks it's the logic of inflation. So if you simply produce everything in your own country, you don't use comparative advantage, you don't buy the cheapest thing, prices are higher, right? You can imagine if we apply this logic to China and we don't want to buy anything made in China, your shirts are going to get a lot more expensive and you won't be able to buy other things. So Smith sees this logic, that the logic of empire and of not trading with other countries, which he thinks is one of the sacred rights of mankind, same rights that the founders want. In the Declaration of Independence, we want to trade with all people. That actually makes the most economic sense too. Why? Because wealth isn't money. Wealth is the purchasing power of money. Early on, Hamilton, if you take 1782, Hamilton says, forget these wild speculative paradoxes of free trade. He's read Smith by then. I think we know this. And he says, but that's just theoretical. Wise and enlightened nations do this, and we should emulate them. So early on, Hamilton sort of bent towards practice, has him emulate these European empires and their economic theory. Again, mercantilism, balance of trade. A positive balance of trade is the term for this, which just means export more than you import, buy American, don't buy from China, this sort of logic. That's what's going to be. There's a second idea of wealth. And Smith, it's interesting, in the fourth book of Wealth of Nations, only devotes one of the nine chapters of that book to the second kind of wealth. And I think the reason he only develops one book is he said, this is for eggheads, this is for theorists. Smith, like Hamilton in a way, is interested in what's possible in practice. But the French economists of the Enlightenment, so Turgot, Quesnay, Destutt de Toissy, if you read the encyclopedia, these are the theories of economics you have here. This is the reason why when we use the word laissez-faire, this is why we say it in French. Quesnay is telling a story about how China works. And he's actually translating the term wu wei, which in China is from Lao Tzu and the Taoists. Don't act, don't do anything. And Quesnay says, this makes sense. He's sort of idealizing China. This makes the most sense. Don't interfere, don't try to promote manufacturers, don't stop your country from trading to pile up money, because wealth is actually in the farms and in produce of land. So wealth isn't money, wealth is in produce. Because the one thing you can't make too much of is food. Now, to many of my students, that doesn't make sense, but they live in a world that hasn't experienced a famine, because democratic countries haven't experienced a famine in a very, well, ever, since they've been around. But if you live in a world with periodic famine, the idea that food surplus, you can't have enough food, right? That'll lead to population growth and ultimately economic growth makes a lot more sense. Smith, look, and Jefferson is in, this is why Jefferson wants those ideas to be true, thinks those ideas. Jefferson's Francophilia. Jefferson is reading, and I mean, both of these guys are amazingly read. You can't emphasize that enough. Jefferson wants more Americans to read these French economists to see, and that's cutting edge. I think we want to watch the Hamilton musical and say, Jefferson's the old-fashioned jazz number. he's stuck in the past with his economic ideas. In fact, Jefferson is in the mainstream of most of the economic theorizing, kind of cutting edge at the time, that wealth is food or wealth is produce. Anyway, Smith looks at that world and he says, neither. Wealth is purchasing power. And then you read Wealth of Nations to see the, you know, that account. But if Smith, if he has to choose, says that the physiocrats are better, they just will never have a special interest behind them. So we'll never see any government just decide to laissez-faire, let it be, and let the farmers farm. And let wealth come from the earth.
So Chris, that's interesting to me. Then if Jefferson thinks that wealth is rooted in land, then he's going to think a country like America with this vast land, that the business then is cultivating the land. The business of the entrepreneur, the free enterpriser in the early days is let's do agriculture.
Professor Wiley reminds me, I think a big difference between Jefferson and Hamilton is how they're thinking in terms of empire. I do think that's a big, important difference. It reminds me that in Federalist One, written by Alexander Hamilton in 1787, he talks about what's at stake in ratification of the Constitution is the fate of this most interesting empire in the world, right? Or one of the most. And he actually uses the term empire to describe the potential of the United States to grow, right? But to be an empire of 13 states and maybe more eventually. And what that reminds me of is in terms of wealth creation, Hamilton really is thinking in terms of building our own empire. And you might even call it, Hamilton is thinking in terms of maybe creating the world's largest free trade zone, maybe the first free trade zone in the United States as a kind of free trade empire. And that will continue to create opportunities for future growth and expansion, not just in terms of territory, but it will lead to a perpetual generation of an increase of wealth. Whereas I don't think Jefferson is thinking in those terms. I don't know that Jefferson, again, is thinking of, you know, the United States will grow and it will expand. Obviously, he was responsible for the Louisiana Purchase. But the benefit of the purchase of territory or the acquisition of territory is to provide more land so that we can then find the value of wealth in that land and what it can produce for a growing population. So I do think both of them have growth different. They both are aiming at growing wealth, but what they, again, as Professor Wiley very nicely articulated, they see the sources of wealth rooted in different things. And I think there's a more urgency on the part of Hamilton to grow that wealth more rapidly, whereas Jefferson seems to be willing to allow that to happen over time as we acquire and move westward, and then our population slowly increases. I think Hamilton, by the way, is thinking also in terms of the East Coast of the United States already in the 1780s and 90s is becoming quite populated, and there simply isn't the opportunity to allow for this slow growth in terms of population, gradual diffusion of property among people, and the accumulation of property by more and more people, because you already have a different demographic in the East than the West. Jefferson's ideals, I think economic ideals are suited for a growing West, and Hamilton's, I think, are important for the rapidly a growing population of the East.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
So that's very interesting to me. And I want to, by the way, I want to encourage those who are with us, if you want to submit your questions, feel free to do that. We'll start to get some in. But in the meantime, I want to follow up on that point, Chris, and maybe this is just for both of you. The idea of sort of owning your labor, creatively deploying the labor of your mind, of course, which is probably the most important human labor, but also of your hands, whether that's in manufacturing, nudge toward that, as Hamilton says, or whether that's in agriculture and farming, the creation of prosperity and increase in prosperity, it assumes, maybe it's a fair assumption, but it assumes that national prosperity is a good thing. That it's good for countries to get rich, to have wealth. That wasn't always the belief of people who ran societies, particularly republics. What good did Jefferson and Hamilton think wealth was, national prosperity was, for the country?
So yeah, another great question. Ancient republics tended to frown upon the overaccumulation of wealth.
Like Sparta, Rome, if you were a true Spartan or Roman, you weren't supposed to want to get rich.
Yes, yeah. But it detracted from, the educations in those kinds of republics were all aimed at producing citizen warriors. And the emphasis of education and mores in those societies was placed on civic duty, the dedication of the citizens to the good of the city or the whole of the republic, preparation for defense and warfare. And I think they tended to view the effect of wealth on citizens as having a softening effect. It could potentially open the door to a desire for luxury, ultimately softness, and a lack of preparation to defend oneself. I think what Hamilton and Jefferson saw was the potential for population growth, for increases in population to mitigate the effects that wealth might bring. Wealth might bring a desire for more comfort, more wealth, more luxury in a democracy. But when you make it a large republic, and I think both of them agree that there's a big difference between a large republic and what Hamilton, as you pointed out, Jeff, those petty republics of Greece and Italy, Hamilton calls them, right, in the Federalists. The problem there is they're small. So they have to have an education that's geared towards civic defense or civic education, civic virtue, a kind of warrior ethos. But in a large republic, when you're generating wealth and you're therefore, potentially growing your country along with that, increases in population could perhaps become substitutes for that intense, warrior education that previous republics depended on so much for their survival.
Rob, can you say a little bit more about why founders thought that national prosperity was a good thing?
Sure. I think it's important to emphasize that they're in the middle. There are certainly voices who think that commerce is a panacea. They draw on Montesquieu's arguments, the French political scientist of the middle 18th century, Montesquieu's arguments that commerce softens mores, that commercial republics will be the strongest republics militarily. He has sort of Britain in mind as a powerful country that shows how commerce can become power in the modern world after the invention of the compass. And there are some in the founding era who think that because America is a commercial republic or spun off of the sort of British commercial society, we don't need strong institutions. You see Hamilton try to nip that in the bud in Federalist 6. No. And if Dr. Burkett and I were on an excellent thesis panel of one of our Ashbrook scholars who pointed out in Federalist 6 that Hamilton looks back to ancient commercial republics like Carthage and says, hey, they fought wars too. And our wars and our commerce might get us into wars. We're going to need strong institutions. So yes to commerce. Yes, commerce is going to make us a stronger country. We should build a commercial republic. We are a commercial republic, maybe if we like it or not. But we're going to need strong institutions. We're going to need a navy and a strong executive, et cetera. Jefferson's worried in a little bit of a different way, I think, about how wealth creates dependence. And this is why he thinks that the farmer, the yeoman farmer, the independent farmer who's dependent on nobody will be a better citizen than the mobs of the city who compares to sores. Jefferson, I think, has a real worry that a shift of Americans from being a nation of mostly farmers to manufacturing workers will be a baleful shift. I think we have a lot of hindsight in American history to know that manufacturing workers have acquitted themselves well, served in the military, died on D-Day, and so on, and were patriotic citizens. But I remind my students today that when we think about the contemporary America, 80% of Americans neither work in manufacturing, these artificers that Hamilton talks about promoting, nor farming. So agriculture, less than 2%, manufacturing, about 19%. But 80% of Americans are part of a service economy. And we should really think about the effects of what job do you do every day, and what kind of citizen does that make you? Because that's really this question between, should we worry? Should we be a stronger, should we be a strong country? Even Smith was worried about Scotland and England becoming nations of industrial workers. And he was worried about their, once the division of labor got so far that people were doing simple tasks all day, you know, in whistles and factories on shifts with belt, that they'd become subservient and dependent. And this was a real question. We reduce these thinkers to theories sometimes, as if it's all very neat. And of course we do that because the students have to understand the basics and should be, but you have to also remember that they were seeing changes in the world in the early Industrial Revolution. They had real questions. We can think about how our history has gone and the answer to those questions too. But we should kind of appreciate them as, I mean, especially Jefferson and Hamilton as extremely studied, extremely well-read. I hope our politicians are half as well-read.
You're being optimistic.
Hamilton are, I wouldn't bet on it, and modesty would forbid them for saying so anyway. But they really had questions about the kind of world they were entering, this world of specialization, and what citizenship would look like in it.
Go ahead, Chris.
Can I add? No, that's very thoughtful. I just, Rob made me think of another thing I think that Jefferson and Hamilton had in common in terms of what they thought was good about commerce and the generation of wealth. And that is that they both had a certain understanding of progress, not sort of the progress that was espoused by, you know, people like Woodrow Wilson and others later, which was very theoretical in some ways. But I think they both recognized that that the generation of wealth is not done for the sake of generating wealth. Wealth creates opportunity. And Jefferson, I think it's important to remember, was an inventor, right? And tried to, you know, invent this and he invented that. And I think Jefferson was always thinking in terms of how the creation of wealth could improve the generation of wealth. And free trade and free enterprise and all these things, it led people to become innovative, right? So they're driven to become better in their markets, to come up with a better product or to distribute things in a better way. And this allows the human mind to engage in a kind of creativity, right? That's what entrepreneurship really is in a certain way. It's being creative. And this would have, this would mean not only would we be able to feed a growing population, but we would see a kind of improvement or increase in the quality of human life. Now, again, with Jefferson, and I think Hamilton agreed with that, but again, Jefferson wanted to, I think, temper that with a little bit with a need for an education that also gave us the kinds of virtues of moderation and self-restraint and maybe frugality. Ironically, with Jefferson, perhaps he was not the model of frugality. But so a good kind of republic where you have an education that teaches people to handle wealth responsibly, but at the same time encourages people to go out and be inventive and be creative, that's really going to lead to the kind of progress I think Jefferson envisioned for this country.
So we're starting to get a few questions in now, and this is an interesting one. It goes off of what both of you were saying, which is the person asks, so what kind of, I think they're envisioning asking Jefferson and Hamilton this, so I'll ask you two this. What kind of education should young people have if we want to continue free enterprise in the republic that we have? So, and I'll just add, Hamilton would say, everybody, young people need to go out and be supply chain management majors. And Jefferson would say, no, they need to read ancient Greek philosophy. Or was there some agreement on what they thought people, citizens in a republic, the kind of education they should get?
I think about book five of Aristotle's Republic, where he says, or sorry, Aristotle's Politics, where he says the best protection against faction is education relative to the regime. But why would I say something about civic education and education about what America is in particular, right? Not about the course of history in general, not about economic science prescinding from what makes America exceptional. It's because both Jefferson and Hamilton had the pluck to believe that America was an exceptional country and that they had to think through all of this economic and political theory and what it would look like in America. And they had the pluck to believe that America was different. So Jefferson's writing to Jean-Baptiste Say, author of Say's Law, Supply Creates Its Own Demand. He's writing to him in 1804, right? So he's president of the United States. He's writing from from the presidency, right? He's writing from Washington. And he says, you know, Malthus, you've written for Europe. But I wonder what you would say to America. We have all this land, right? So my theories about land, won't this work in America? Don't tell me your theories for Europe, right? He was like this in you know, zoology and botany and the natural sciences too, right? And Hamilton too, right, begins the report on manufacturers by saying, general theories admit of all sorts of exceptions. We know we have land in America, but actually we have to nudge people to manufacturing to promote immigration. People won't emigrate from Europe unless they have jobs here. And so we need to make those jobs for them because many people will want to flee Europe. It's 1791, the wars of the French Revolution are raging. And one thing that Hamilton has an eye on is emigration. People are going to want to become Americans. But to make people want to become Americans, we need to think about what's exceptional about America. There's a lot of embarrassment talking about American exceptionalism. There shouldn't be when you're talking about designing an economy in the 1740s. Not a lot of people have been blessed to found a new, right, which Jefferson will call an empire of liberty, Hamilton, Federalist One. Not a lot of people are blessed to think about what can I do creating an empire in a new country, a country endowed with a ton of natural resources. So Hamilton writes about fossil coal. And when he writes about iron, he sees that we have possibilities of energy affordability and possibilities of energy independence that no other country has. He doesn't think about it as a separate natural resource. Sometimes he's wrong, by the way. So there's an audacity to Hamilton. That European theory is fine. That general theory is fine. America's an exception. Here's what we can do. There's a kind of audacity or pluck. He's wrong about cotton. He thinks the future of America is going to be in hemp. And he says, cotton, the quality of our cotton's never that good. And then there's a lesson here. This is December 1791. 2 years later, Eli Whitney invents the cotton gin. Cotton production quadruples. The number of enslaved people in America quadruples. And there's a sobering lesson here, too, I think, that you think you have figured out as a policymaker, especially if you're a Hamiltonian, you think that policymakers have something to do with natural prosperity. So Hamilton's not laissez-faire. He wants to give people those nudges. And he is colossally wrong about the future of American economy in the South. And he belongs to a generation, you know, totally underrated founder like Oliver Ellsworth, right? Says slavery won't be a speck in America. It's going away, right? Under the technological conditions of 1787, that might be true. But by the early 1790s and the invention of a technological innovation no one could foresee changed the course of American history as soon as the Constitution had been written. And that's one of the tragedies of American history, but it's also one of the lessons for us, I think, that we need to keep thinking like the founders thought. And we need to believe that America is a country, it's an exceptional country, it's a country that we can think about. We can think about how they thought about it, and also what they didn't know. And I think we're kind of invited to do that. So the one lesson is, if you want an education, it should be a civic education in what America is, because it might be something different than other countries, and it might not just be part of a general economics or political science. You have to study our civic tradition.
That's really interesting. Chris, what would you add to that?
Yeah, well, we know in terms of the education that Jefferson thought people should receive, we know Jefferson left behind a plan for education, right? A curriculum for the University of Virginia. And he also wrote extensively on the kind of education people in the state of Virginia should receive. Everybody should receive a certain kind of education that prepared them to be free in the sense that they could, you know, they could read, they could do numbers. They weren't dependent on others for, you know, keeping their books or their records for them. So for Jefferson, the education that mattered most was an education that was geared toward making us free and independent, that is not dependent on anybody else for our lives, for our opinions, for our jobs, of course, right, or whatever it might be. But we also know that a lot of the founders, including Hamilton and George Washington, were in favor of creating a kind of national university. And I'm not sure that, I don't know that Jefferson, I think Jefferson was in support of that, but it didn't happen because at the Constitutional Convention, the delegates wanted to keep the responsibility for education to each state to determine for itself what kind of education they wanted within their state. So a national university didn't happen, but I think that the idea behind that was, for Washington and Hamilton, a national university would bring together people from these various states and different ways of life, and would bring students together from all these parts of the country where manufacturing was more prominent, farming was more prominent, and you would have this great intermixture of ideas, and together they could work and they could see how farming and manufacturers actually worked hand in hand to make each way of life better. I think that was one of the ideas behind a national university, and of course the idea of passing on important civic virtues, dedication to the good of one's country and one's fellow citizens, and these sorts of things. But I think there is that bigger idea that if we can just bring people together from these different parts of the country, the different states, they can find ways to work together and make the whole better somehow. And I think, by the way, maybe I shouldn't do that, but I was going to skip ahead. I know when I bring Abraham Lincoln, I'm skipping ahead, 60 years or something, But I think that's something that Abraham Lincoln, that's the way Abraham Lincoln thought too. And Abraham Lincoln, as you know, he praised Jefferson for having the right principles. But I think he thought like a Hamiltonian or a Whig, in the sense that what's good for the nation is creating opportunities for people to go out and build something, right? To start with, maybe you work for somebody else for a wage, and you save, and then within 5 years you're able to buy a cart and a donkey, and you start your own business, and then 20 years later you hire 3 people to work for you or 10 people to work for you, right? And then, so I think they both envisioned that happening, Jefferson and Hamilton, but I think Hamilton's view of these things was, I'd say, it's more continental. In a way, it would apply to more of the states than just parts or sections of it.
Here's another question. We've got time for just a couple more, but here's another question from our audience, which is, did founders like Jefferson and Hamilton favor enterprise over war?
Yes. Yeah, I think so. I think so. Yes.
Absolutely. I think they thought that a country that prepared for war ought to be an enterprising country. So sometimes
Rob, what do you mean by that? That's an interesting statement.
Yeah, so sometimes we think that perhaps raiding rather than trading is a good path to development. Seemed to be a Genghis Khan strategy that you can enrich yourself through war. Adam Smith has a problem with this because he thinks countries that refuse to trade already on a war footing are countries that don't become prosperous. And the countries that in a way over-prepare for war end up losing those wars to countries that don't. So that seems to be Smith's paradox. Locke has something quite similar. If you respect people's private property rights, you, the prince, will quickly become too hard for your neighbors, Locke writes. Both Hamilton and Jefferson are absolutely in this tradition. I think that Professor Burkitt mentioned when he was talking about the National University and the hope that artificers or manufacturers would help farmers and agriculture vice versa, very much Smith's path to development. Hamilton, by report on manufacturers, has come around to that. So if early Hamilton was a little bit more in that mercantilist war footing, the young Hamilton seems to praise those European statesmen like Colbert, the one who had to be told laissez-faire, let us do the thing. The later Hamilton seems to have read his Smith a lot closer and comes to agree. And actually, in the report on manufacturers, disagrees with physiocrats. There's an article by a historian named Edward Bourne from the late 1890s. He's the sort of doyen of Latin American history in America, taught at Case Western and finished his career at Yale, which goes through 20 different points in Report on the Manufacturers that are basically lifted straight from Wealth of Nations.
Alexander Hamilton, plagiarist?
Might have flagged a little bit of a, if I turned it into Turn It In, it might flag it, and I might have to give Hamilton an F for the greatest Treasury report ever written, right? And Bourne speculates that Hamilton would have found it inconvenient to be quoting an English economist, which always pains me because Smith, of course, was a Scot. But anyway, he doesn't want to mention a foreign economist, and maybe that's some of the exceptionalism. I just want to say one quick thing about the education piece, just to follow through. Personal financial literacy is a really important topic to people today who realize that, you know, high school students can go into a lifetime of debt by their own free decision. There's no minimum age to take out a federally subsidized university loan in this country. So you can go into a lifetime of debt, even if you can't buy a pack of cigarettes or something like that, which some of us will raise our eyebrows about. The founders were really concerned about this, not that they were also always in great financial straits themselves. So Jefferson, for example, writes in the twilight of his second term as president to his daughter Martha, "I know of nothing more important to inculcate into the minds of young people than the wisdom, the honor, and the blessed comfort of living within their income. You should learn personal financial literacy." And in those 1780s questions leading up to the Constitution, which are a lot of economic questions, how do we get tariffs right? How do we get trade right? How do we adjust the Articles of Confederation to make a more powerful country? Adams writes to Jefferson that all the perplexities, confusions, and distresses of America arise not so much from defects in their constitutions or confederation, nor from a want of honor or virtue, so much as from downright ignorance of the nature of coin, credit, and circulation. And so there's an old history that goes back to the founders who say, you need to learn personal financial literacy. Americans need that. That's a civic duty. And you also need to think about public finance. You also need to think about economics. You can't simply do sort of legal theory or moral theory, live in the theoretical country you like to live in. And Jefferson doesn't, you know, he I think doesn't have to even learn that lesson from Adams. He agrees with that. And it's important to think about those things. It's important to think about today, our energy policy, our national debt, trade policy. All these are, still up for debate, and nothing excuses us to sort of weasel out of it and read history. We have a country, right. We have a country to take care of out there. We should read all this stuff and then go back and apply what we learned, the sort of principles that we learned from serious engagement with these.
Yeah, that emphasis on individual responsibility and not going into debt is something that was shared by a lot of the founders. In fact, Benjamin Franklin had a lot to say about that as well. So I was just going to say very quickly, if you don't mind.
This question, Chris?
Sorry?
That's all right. Can I follow up? I've got time, I think, for one last
question. Oh, sure. Yeah, please.
Connected to the point that you're making there, which is the question is, the questioner says, I know that Jefferson and Hamilton disagreed about the national debt at the time of the American founding, but would they be alarmed about our national debt today?
Yes.
Yeah.
Jefferson has in the Earth Belongs to the Living letter that he sends to Madison. Jefferson doesn't like the idea of a government contracting any debt that will take more than 19 and a half years to pay. The thought that in 19 and a half years, the living, then that's the, like entails, that would be the dead ruling over the living. So Jefferson not only would not like the national debt, Jefferson would have a philosophical objection to the Treasury selling 30-year notes or any bond over 19 and a half years. And that's a principled objection that I think Jefferson would have. It's in theory. Now, the founders, remember, conceive a country in debt. And someone's got to pay for the American Revolution, and the country as a whole is in debt, or the states are in debt, and there's a debate about the federal government. So there's no option, right? We owe the French, we owe the Spanish, and we owe the Dutch. And a lot of Americans believe, of course, that was worth doing. And then it's not until 1836 that debt is completely paid off. The question is whether we should keep a national debt to improve the country. Hamilton falls on that side. The Whigs, Lincoln, of course, Henry Clay. Who makes Hamilton, who makes Hamilton's tariff the reason we celebrate the 4th of July, July 4th, 1789. That's why we celebrate July 4th, because the tariff could fund these internal improvements and we ought to go into debt and do that. So that's sort of the American system in its sort of apogee, the way that Henry Clay is. And why in 1832? Because we're about to pay down the debt. And Clay says, no, 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 we have the debt and we have the bank to improve the country, not just to pay off the revolution. I think Jefferson would have serious disagreements about that. Hamilton didn't want excessive debt. And one of Hamilton's reasons for supporting the American Revolution was that he thought that the British Empire had gone into excessive debt to fight the Seven Years' War on this continent, the French and Indian War, and that would lead to crippling taxes. So Hamilton, although he's in favor of a debt of a certain amount, in fact is not in favor of an excessive and crippling debt, which eventually, and that's no taxation without representation, Americans had no choice but to be taxed for that particularly onerous debt. I think both of them would come together and say a $30 trillion national debt is an absolute abdication of the principles of the founding, and totally endangers us losing the republic they founded. That's a bit grim. Many ways, I think we've really succeeded in building a republic that would have blown the founders away, and they would have been impressed with a lot of things that Americans have done throughout our history. But the price tag that we've accrued for that and the way that we're financing that, I think they would be seriously concerned about, and I think we ought to be too.
Yeah, for Jefferson, every penny, every dollar of foreign debt that we owed was that much, we were that much less independent. National independence for Jefferson is directly tied to foreign debt. And that's why Jefferson was not in favor of any foreign debt, or at bare minimum. Hamilton, I'm just re-saying what you said, Rob. I think you're much more articulate. But Hamilton was willing to carry a certain amount of foreign debt. But that's a prudential call. You have to balance what our potential for generating wealth is, right, against the kind of foreign debt that we hold. It's not crippling if we can repay it or pay it off pretty quickly. So some foreign debt is a good thing for Hamilton because it gives us room for investments and improvements and all the things that you mentioned. But for Jefferson, I think you're right when you said that he saw debt as a fundamental violation of the principles, especially the principle of national independence that the country was built on. So,
oh, that's fascinating. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I know I'm sorry if we didn't get to your questions. I really appreciate you taking the time. We're at our time, so I want to take a moment to just thank our panelists, Chris Burkett, Rob Wiley. Boy, what a fascinating discussion, and you can see how relevant it is even for issues today, thinking about free enterprise, government, and national prosperity. Thanks for joining us today, and I want to thank our audience, our listeners, for taking the time to be with us for this conversation. It's a really important topic. We're going to keep talking about it. The issues of free enterprise, wealth creation, and prosperity are an important part of what Ashbrook does and what we study. Thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.